today on the world. 60,000 about to sit down to watch soccer in London as the pandemic continues. For one British immunologist, it's like playing with fire.
My friends and colleagues working in intensive care and infectious diseases really feel like they're bearing the brunt of a kind of government experiment.
I'm Marco Werman, and in Honduras, a guilty verdict for a conspirator in the murder of environmental activist Berta Cáceres.
With the right pressure, justice can be served.
We also hear how some seniors in U.S. Chinatowns stay stylish.
A very eclectic mix of clothes that they've held over from Hong Kong, combined with things that they have made themselves or were gifted to them from their grandkids.
Pro tip, it's all in the layering. All of that and more today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. Welcome. Hosting a big European soccer tournament during a pandemic was always going to be a risk. After 3 weeks of play, it feels somewhat reassuring to see England and Denmark heading into a semi-final tomorrow night at Wembley Stadium in London. With a stadium at three-quarters capacity, that's about 60,000 people. Also, this week, the UK government announced that it's lifting many COVID restrictions. And there's this. The Delta variant of COVID-19 is spreading rapidly in Britain, and many scientists say the situation is a recipe for disaster. The World's Europe correspondent Orla Barry reports.
It's been 25 years since England got this far in the European Football Championships. Here was the moment in Rome last Saturday when England fans knew their team was heading to the semi-finals.
Ukraine blown away! England on their way! Ripping their way to the semi-finals of the European Championship.
Thousands took to the streets of London to celebrate. And it's scenes like these that have health experts concerned. The Delta coronavirus variant is surging in Britain and other parts of Europe. Public health officials say big football matches aren't helping. In Finland last month, COVID cases doubled in the week following its game against Russia. Most of those infected are thought to be football fans who went to the match. In Scotland, the Public Health Authority has linked 2,000 new cases to its game against England in June, when thousands of Scotland fans travelled to London. Most of the fans didn't have tickets and instead partied in central London. Among them was 21-year-old Michael McLean from Inverness.
I'm not going to lie, it was amazing to see. It was an amazing experience.
A few days after coming home, McLean told BBC Scotland he began to feel unwell.
I went into work the next day and that's when I started to feel ill and got a proper PCR test on the way home, and that came back positive the following day.
Almost 400 Scotland fans who actually went to the stadium for the game tested positive too. The crowd on that night was around 22,000. But tomorrow night, 60,000 fans are expected for the England-Denmark match. Lloyd Griffith plans to be there.
I am feeling confident, but you just never know what will happen.
Griffith is a well-known British comedian, and if you're a fan of the TV show Ted Lasso, you might recognise him. He plays a journalist called Lloyd in the series. Griffith tells me that lead actors Jason Sudeikis and Brendan Hunt are real-life fans of English football.
Yeah, Jason and Brendan, like, oh, they're big football fans. I mean, Brendan especially, who plays Coach Beard. So, like, they're aware of what soccer is.
Griffith has been to Wembley Stadium already this season. He watched England beat Germany a couple of weeks ago. And at first, he says, he was nervous about being in the crowd.
Especially in the UK, that we've just been told that we're going to have to deal with COVID, then, you know, anxiety levels are a little bit heightened when you go into big crowds. And I was a little bit anxious, but, you know, sadly, a beer later, I was fine.
Under the stadium's rules, fans must be vaccinated or provide a negative test result. But Griffith says it's not exactly bulletproof.
I mean, not to poo-poo it, but the system is flawed. Like, you can just put in that you've got a negative test, even if you might be testing positive. So you just have to hope that people, you know, if they do get a positive test, don't go along.
Prime Minister Boris Johnson was asked this week if he had any advice for England fans.
I think my advice to everybody would be to support England, but enthusiastically, but in a responsible way. And the events at Wembley clearly have particular conditions attached to them, particular testing requirements, which, you know, we will insist on.
On Monday, Johnson also announced that most restrictions will be lifted in England on July 19th. That means no more mandatory mask wearing or social distancing. British immunologist Danny Altman is worried.
No masks on public transport, for example, is an incredibly high risk exercise. All my friends and colleagues working in intensive care and infectious diseases really feel like they're bearing the brunt of a kind of government experiment, and like they're kind of battle fatigued and had enough. And now they're kind of gearing up for battle again.
The British Health Secretary said today the country is heading into uncharted territory and could soon see up to 100,000 COVID cases a day. Altman says things could be even worse.
I think that's possibly an underestimate. If we choose to be a country that doesn't really handle it properly and says we've decided that we can tolerate 100,000 to 200,000 cases per day, it will be mutating, it will be generating variants of concern.
Boris Johnson's government says that Britain must learn to live with COVID. If England beats Denmark tomorrow night, fans will head to Wembley Stadium once again on Sunday for the championship final. Health experts are hoping that it's a football victory and not the virus that's coming home at the end of the tournament. For The World, I'm Orla Barry in London.
Yesterday, a verdict came down in a closely watched murder case in Honduras. A court found that a former construction firm executive was guilty of collaborating to kill indigenous leader Berta Cáceres in 2016. Cáceres was well known in Honduras and among environmentalists worldwide for rallying the indigenous Lenca people of Honduras against the construction of a massive dam there. For her work, Cáceres won the prestigious Goldman Environmental Prize.
La madre tierra militarizada, cercada, envenenada, donde se violan sistemáticamente derechos elementales, nos exige actuar.
Cáceres accepted the award, saying Mother Earth, poisoned, militarized, is begging us to act now. To talk about Berta Cáceres and the verdict, author and journalist Nina Lacani joins me from New York. She's author of the book Who Killed Berta Cáceres? Nina, a few years ago, several men had already been convicted of murdering Ms. Cáceres. Why is yesterday's verdict so important?
Yesterday's verdict is absolutely historic. In that first trial in 2018, the seven men that were found guilty were really a combination of the hired hitmen and the middlemen, those that served as sort of links between the planners, the coordinators and the hitmen. Yesterday, David Castillo was found guilty, and he was the most senior person to date to have been held responsible for the murder. He's a former military intelligence officer who was trained in the prestigious West Point Academy here in New York State, a former government employee, and he was president of the dam company, which Berta was leading the opposition against, and which the court has ruled was why she was killed. You know, she was killed, they were very clear in both trials, because her opposition to the dam had delayed the project and caused financial losses to the shareholders. And that included Castillo and many others who are yet to face account.
How did we get here to this guilty verdict in a country like Honduras, where it is tough to get justice and where there is ongoing violence against indigenous people, against women and activists?
Yeah, I mean, Honduras continues to be the most dangerous country in the world to defend the environment and land. It's one of the most dangerous places in the world to be a woman, to be a lawyer, to be a journalist. And that's because impunity is the norm. You know, justice is very, very rare. And it's absolutely, you know, it never happens for those who are in power, for those economic elites that basically rule the country. We got to this point because of the, you know, really amazing and immense sort of campaign and pressure by Berta Cáceres' family, her four children, her mother, her colleagues, and many others in Honduras and outside of Honduras. You know, she was very well known. She was probably the most celebrated sort of defender activist in Latin America at the time of her murder. She was internationally acclaimed. And really many groups and organizations have taken up this cause and really demanding that in a country where there is never justice, that there is some justice for her.
Nina, as you said earlier, Honduras is one of the toughest and most dangerous places in the world to be an environmental activist. To what extent did the murder of Cáceres in 2016 increase the chilling effect? And what will this verdict do, if anything, to change that?
I mean, I think it is a, you know, really significant verdict. I think it's shown that when there is pressure, international and national pressure, that the state can be forced to prosecute at least some of those involved. But the fact is, you know, Bertha's murder sort of triggered widespread condemnation, but it didn't stop the killing, and it certainly didn't stop the criminalization of defenders. You know, right now there are dozens and dozens of indigenous and other rural people in jail, detained because they are opposing projects that contaminate their water, projects that have been sort of imposed on their territories without their permission, land that's been taken away from them. So, you know, I think this sort of wave of criminalization and violence continues, but this is a hugely important verdict and victory because it shows that even in a country like Honduras, which is fundamentally a criminal state, with the right pressure, justice can be served, and it has been partially served in this case.
Nina Lacani is a senior reporter at The Guardian newspaper. She's also author of the book, Who Killed Berta Cáceres? Dams, Death Squads, and an Indigenous Defender's Battle for the Planet. Nina, thank you very much for speaking with us today.
Thank you.
Armenians are in mourning today for a man whose own music can best be described as mournful, Javan Gasparian, a master of the reed instrument, the duduk. You might not know his name, but you most likely have heard Gasparian's duduk. He's performed with Peter Gabriel, also with Lionel Richie. That's Gasparian with a 30-second duduk intro to Richie's hit, Now You're Gone. Hollywood also turned to Gasparian for the plaintive mood he created, like with the 2000 film Gladiator. In a promotional interview for the movie, composer Hans Zimmer spoke about his determination to have Javan Gasparian as part of the movie's soundtrack.
And I kept thinking, I want to write for him. I want this to be about him. And everybody kept saying, just give up. He lives in Armenia. Unless you go to Armenia, it's never going to happen.
But it did. Gasparian happened to be in Los Angeles, and Zimmer's wish came true. There was one small problem, though, that Hans Zimmer and Javan Gasparian cleverly managed to work through.
And it was great because he doesn't speak a word of English. You know, he's a god in his own country. He has his own vodka named after him. And if you drink enough of this vodka, the ice will melt and his face is on the inside of the label. You'll actually get to see his face. And so our communication, of course, was drinking vodka until we could see his face and him playing like a god.
Armenians have long known about Gasparian's heavenly skills on the duduk. If his music was ever taken out of context by Western pop or Hollywood, the payback for Armenia was pride. As none other than Armen Sarkisian, the president of Armenia, said today, Javan Gasparian has presented our folk music on multiple stages in world cinema, making our national culture understandable and available for foreign audiences for decades. Javan Gasparian was 92. In eastern Turkey, there is a kind of cheese that is so central to local culture that no local breakfast table can go without it. We'll take you there and sample just ahead. You're listening to The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. If the gas lines are any indication, keep an eye out for Lebanon. It's going through seriously tough economic times right now. There are shortages of food, electricity, and medicine, and gas lines that stretch up to 4 hours. Today, Lebanon's caretaker Prime Minister Hassan Diab said that the country is days away from a social explosion. Those were his words, without help from the international community. To understand what's happening and how this is affecting people in Lebanon, we turn to Lebanese economist Mohamed Faour. He joins us from Dublin. I'm curious what you make of the Prime Minister's comments that the country's days away from a social explosion.
Well, to begin with, it's quite ridiculous, to put it very lightly. The fact that the country's Prime Minister still thinks that a social explosion is yet to happen. It speaks volumes about the extent of the disconnect between Lebanon's executive political class, basically, and the people and what they're going through as right now.
Yeah, living amidst the worst economic crisis, one of them since the 1800s, that's according to the World Bank. So what led up to all this?
Simply said, Lebanon has lived well beyond its means. It has consumed well beyond its means, at the very least since the 1990s. So you're having a banking crisis where banks no longer have dollars to pay back their depositors. You have what's termed as a balance of payment crisis, where Lebanon can no longer import as much as it used to because it no longer has as much dollars as it used to. You have a fiscal crisis because of a government running consistent double-digit deficit. All led to this.
Not surprising that Lebanon's currency has lost 90% of its value recently. I'm just wondering, how are ordinary Lebanese able to buy their groceries or pay their bills?
Based on the last estimates by the World Bank, 55% of Lebanese households live under the poverty line. So this speaks volumes about how bad things are. And right now, the fact that it's only 55% only, even though it's a huge number, but I'm saying that because it could have been way worse, or it was supposed to be way worse, is that the government or the central bank is still, to a limited extent, subsidizing the imports of certain basic necessities, even though it's right now rationing it more and more. One of them is fuel, for example. The fact that right now you're having fuel shortages is because not enough subsidized fuel is coming into the country. And this is the only thing that is maintaining whatever little purchasing power is left of whatever is left of Lebanese middle-income households. So they're just burning through reserves. And at this current pace, there will be a time when, if nothing happens, if things stay the way they currently are, reserves, the mandatory reserves, reach zero, and then you can no longer import.
We reported recently on our show on soldiers who can't feed their families. I mean, we know the situation is really desperate in Lebanon. What is keeping Lebanon's government from implementing reforms or some changes? What are they doing about this?
Well, it's policy in action. And some people argue, and I'm getting closer and closer to believing this argument, that policy in action is a deliberate policy choice. Policy in action is leaving the economy auto-adjust in the most Darwinian way at the expense of the poorest and the most vulnerable of society.
Mohamed Fayour, what do you think happens if there's no intervention here, if the international community does not come to Lebanon's economic rescue, as the interim prime minister is asking for? Where does that leave Lebanon?
Well, let me be clear. The solution is not with a foreign intervention of any sort. The solution lies within, because the initiative has to start from the Lebanese part of, in as far as implementing serious economic policies that overhaul the whole economic system altogether and halt this free fall that the country is living through right now. What happens if policy in action remains the way it is? In this case, I cannot even fathom what might happen. It's here we're talking about a scenario of continuing free fall. The scenario is frightening, and I cannot even imagine how frightening it would be, because there is no bottom to this as long as policy in action prevails.
Mohamed Fayour is a Lebanese economist based between Beirut and Dublin. Thank you for your thoughts on this, Mohamed.
My pleasure.
In eastern Turkey, in the city of Van, there is a market devoted entirely to cheese. And not just any cheese. This is a regional specialty made from sheep's milk and wild herbs gathered in the mountains. The cheese is an important part of any traditional Van breakfast. That breakfast could be added to UNESCO's list of the world's intangible cultural heritage. As Duri Buscarin reports from the Van Cheese Market, the makers of Van Cheese say they struggle to keep their traditions going when faced with competition from the big cheeses, the industrial producers.
When this cheese producer gets up in the morning, in the village where his family cares for hundreds of sheep, he puts on a checkered sports coat and a flat cap, and he drives into the city with kilos and kilos of white, salty cheese.
He says, since I know myself, I do this cheese.
His name is Islam Soydoğan, and he's 63 years old. Through a translator, he explains how Van cheese is traditionally made with raw sheep's milk, flecked with wild herbs that are grown in the mountains and fed by the snowmelt, garlic, mountain thyme, sometimes even wildflowers. They're heated up in a big pot with enzymes.
And then we put under the ground for minimum 6 months to stay under the ground. And then you can take out and then you can eat it.
The taste is salty, reminiscent of feta, but with something deeper, earthier. Suddenly, I'm looking for crackers, maybe a beer. The translator, Angel Estekalcu, likes it too.
Nom, nom, nom. I like it.
It's good?
This is kind of breakfast in summer. Cheese and watermelon. This cheese and watermelon, it's great.
Van is a city that's Turkish by law and Kurdish by culture. Centuries ago, it was the center of an Armenian kingdom. In this cheese market, almost every shop is devoted to Van's regional specialty. There are soft Van cheeses, hard Van cheese, one that's aged underground and another that's crumbly and meant to be mixed with yogurt. There are plastic tubs of pickled herbs to serve with your cheese. And it's not just residents of Van who are crazy about this cheese. In the shop behind us, big plastic containers are being packed and sealed, ready to be shipped all over the country. The way real Van cheese is made hasn't changed in generations, in a village by someone who takes care of their own sheep. But that way of life is slowly fading away, explains Hassan Kayhan, and real Van cheese isn't always real. The Americans taught us how to cheat, he tells me. In the 1930s, he says, U.S. companies started exporting powdered milk to Turkey, so much so that people in Kayhan's village called it American powder. Now, milk powder is used by less scrupulous cheese producers to keep costs down. The cost of feeding sheep through the winter, he says, has tripled. Kayhan serves as a spokesperson for the bazaar and says his family has run this shop for three generations. He worries that the producers he relies on won't stay in the business much longer. He claims that in 10 years, half of Van cheese made in Turkey will be produced in a factory. But at least for the moment, there seems to be a healthy demand. One woman in a long dress and headscarf says she's buying 75 pounds of the stuff.
I said, what do you do with this? She said, we are actually like tribal. We love guests, so people are coming and going. That's why we buy.
She says she'll freeze half to keep her through the winter, when the sheep aren't giving milk and the cheese doesn't have that same real taste. For The World, I'm Duri Buscarin in the Van Cheese Market.
Take a stroll through that cheese market in eastern Turkey. We've got photos for you at theworld.org. You're listening to The World. Growing old and staying stylish, a new photo project shows how some seniors in U.S. Chinatowns keep up their signature look and inspire younger generations.
I want to be complimented by a gaggle of women when I'm in my 80s. So we try to say, Dosan, good morning, and Popo Holeng. Dang, Grandma, you look good.
That's still ahead here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. We're a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX. This week, we're taking a look at some big themes in U.S. defense and security with Lacey Healy at the PRX National Security Podcast, Things That Go Boom. Today, a biggie, nuclear weapons, a new class of nuclear warheads that's smaller than generations past. You could think of them as baby nuclear weapons, if that helps. They're changing how the U.S. and Russia approach nuclear arms control. Here's Lacey Healy.
Baby nukes go by lots of names. Low-yield nuclear weapons, tactical nuclear weapons, non-strategic nuclear weapons. And just like the name, what exactly constitutes a baby nuke is a little shaky. Throughout our nuclear history, we've tried to cram small nuclear warheads onto everything from short-range missiles to artillery shells, landmines, depth charges, torpedoes. One of these gadgets, the W-54, was literally engineered to fit in a duffel bag. The idea being that a soldier would put the bomb on the ground, set the timer, and run. Which left me wondering, how in the world did this become a thing?
Things are happening.
All right, things are happening. Okay, perfect. To get some context, I called up an expert from the arms control community.
My name is Matt Korda. I'm a research associate at the Federation of American Scientists. We track global nuclear forces across all 9 nuclear armed countries.
And he took me back to the early days of the nuclear program.
The atomic age was born.
And what nuclear bomb technology used to be like.
So early atomic weapons like the ones dropped on Hiroshima and Nagasaki, they were around like 15 to 20 kilotons, which was enough to destroy the majority of a city, but the bombs themselves weighed about 10,000 pounds. Mm.
These bombs did what they were intended to do. But the thinking was that their size might limit the situations where they could be used. For example, if one found oneself with a need to confront the Soviet Union's much larger army on the battlefield, but, you know, not blow absolutely everyone away. So Matt says that after Hiroshima and Nagasaki during the Cold War, there was a push to develop bombs with bigger explosive power in smaller packages.
Newer nuclear weapons, which today we would now know as thermonuclear weapons, can reach these insanely high yields. And we're talking about hundreds of kilotons or even thousands of kilotons, which is almost 100 times the size of those early atomic weapons without actually increasing the weapon's mass. In fact, the bombs got smaller.
These thermonuclear weapons were capable of a much bigger blast, but physically, they were a lot smaller than what the U.S. dropped on Japan, which opened up a whole world of possibilities. This is also where we see the introduction of what we might consider modern-day baby nukes, because some of the thermonuclear weapons had another advantage that we still use today.
What if you don't actually want that ridiculously high yield? What if you decide on what their explosive power is at the moment that you launch them? You can turn to something called dial-a-yield, which it's also called variable yield, but dial-a-yield is a little more descriptive. And when you dial-a-yield, you have the ability to set the bomb's explosive power pretty much anywhere between under a kiloton to several hundred kilotons.
The U.S. has about 1,000 of these dial-a-yield baby nukes in its arsenal right now. But that whole suite of baby nukes are also of questionable utility, since improvements in air defense and radar technology make them tougher to deliver by air. By submarine, however, baby nukes stand a better chance at reaching their targets undeflected, which is exactly why, last year, the Trump administration deployed a brand new submarine-launched baby nuke, the W-76-2. It's a warhead with a yield of about 8 kilotons that can't actually be dialed up and down, but it doesn't need to be. Because on Ohio-class subs, it rides shotgun along some other massively powerful strategic warheads, either of which can be loaded into the exact same missiles. So think of the warheads like Pez, and the missiles like your favorite Garfield Pez dispenser. Load up the missile with your Pez flavor of choice, cherry or grape, a baby nuke, or its way bigger brother. So instead of dial yields, which are flexible across a mid to low range of explosive power, this Pez dispenser system covers both extremes.
The proponents of the warhead describe it as this flexible option. It starts with this idea of something called escalate to de-escalate. In the final years of the Obama administration, there were a number of Western analysts who were convinced that Russia had formally adopted some kind of escalate to de-escalate posture with respect to nuclear weapons. They called for the development of this low-yield warhead for the United States' nuclear-armed submarines with the idea that this capability would counter this new Russian doctrine.
The thing about that, though, Matt says, is that escalate to de-escalate is not an especially useful term, or at least not a particularly fair one to put on Russia, because it's how most states react to threats on a regular basis. There are plenty of examples of countries rolling out and rattling a big fat saber, nuclear or no, to say, hey, we're serious. But beyond that, the evidence that Russia has adopted this policy is also fairly slim. In fact, they've denied it exists.
And so, you know, there are some folks who would say that could Russia be keeping this escalate to de-escalate policy a secret? And in theory, I would say, you know, sure, but it doesn't really make that much sense.
Deterrence is the art of producing in the mind of the enemy the fear to attack.
That's going to lead to a whole bunch of confusion and maybe the potential for catastrophic miscalculation, yeah. Right? So in my mind, it's actually in Russia's interests to communicate their posture very clearly. And at the very least, in public documents, they've been really consistent over the past few decades.
The idea of the U.S. having a small nuke ready for retaliatory action against Russia, it's hard to imagine that not spiraling out of control. Escalate to de-escalate, it just doesn't seem like a winning strategy. So I talked to Rose Gottemuller.
I'm the Payne Distinguished Lecturer at the Freeman Spolee Institute, part of the Center on International Security and Cooperation at Stanford University.
I asked Rose why she thinks the U.S. is invested in building and deploying new baby nukes.
I think that's where you get the arguments that, well, the Russians have more capability because they have more different warhead designs, some of them lower yield, some of them higher yield. We need more equivalence or equality of those capabilities.
Meaning we need baby nukes because the Russians have them. There's one other reason that I wanted to talk to Rose for this episode.
The Strategic Arms Reduction Treaty that is called New START. I was the chief U.S. negotiator in 2009 and 2010.
That's the treaty that limits the number of deployed warheads the U.S. and Russia can have. But importantly, doesn't limit baby nukes, just warheads in general. One of Rose's most vivid memories of negotiating the treaty was toward the end of a round of negotiations.
We were trying, pressing to get finished. And the Russians lost their temper. They said, we're going back to Moscow. We want to take a break. They were on their way to the airport and the Icelandic volcano went off. And as they were, you know, it had been spewing ash for a couple of days. But as they were on the way to the airport, Geneva Airport announced that they were closing because of the ash cloud from the volcano.
Oh, my gosh.
They came back. We finished the work we had to do. I had to laugh.
Mother Nature was on the side of arms control negotiations.
Exactly, exactly. Mother Nature helped us out.
Thanks to Mother Nature and Rose, the treaty was signed by Obama in 2010, pushed through Senate ratification by then Vice President Joe Biden, and just recently, in January 2021, right before it was set to expire, Biden and Vladimir Putin signed on for a 5-year extension, which means we have 5 years to negotiate a follow-on. And there's a chance, even if it's a small one, that that follow-on could include baby nukes. What does it actually look like to get back to the table and talk about some of these things and begin to put these limits in place?
Well, I think we've already seen the Biden administration making a beginning by reaching out very, very quickly to the Kremlin.
Rose says that the U.S. has wanted future talks to go beyond current caps to include specific warheads for some time. And it seems like a promising sign that late in 2020, the Trump administration was able to secure an agreement in principle from Putin to a freeze on warhead production.
And so we'll see how the Russians react. Their president was willing in principle to do it, but then the devil's in the details, as always. And the details have to do with monitoring and verification in very sensitive storage facilities and very sensitive facilities where warheads are handled. So it's going to be tough. We have the same sensitivities.
And she says in the meantime, basically, we have to keep the weapons we have up to date, warheads included. But does it really make sense to build newish weapons like the W76-2 based on a desire to keep up with the Joneses?
Why not? Everyone else is doing it.
Rose says that reasoning is flawed. Deeply flawed.
You know, nuclear attack is something that everybody seeks to avoid. These arguments come down to whether a country is incorporating nuclear weapons and nuclear warheads into a warfighting strategy or not. And that's what the argument is by some experts who say that's exactly what the Russians do. We need to have more equivalence. Mm-hmm. We need to be thinking more in terms of usability of warheads, yeah. Nuclear warfighting. And I just don't agree we need to go there.
In other words, it's one thing to want to maintain a robust enough nuclear arsenal that it serves as a deterrent, while at the same time you negotiate treaties with other nuclear-armed nations to de-weaponize. And it's another thing to start stockpiling weapons because you think you might want to launch them. But maybe the role of baby nukes isn't so much pushing us toward a new posture as much as it's revealing one that's been here for a while.
It kind of implies that using this weapon might be able to preempt some kind of Russian move or to de-escalate a crisis on terms favorable to the United States. But there's not that much evidence to suggest that that kind of thinking is dominant in Russian nuclear culture, but it does exist in some form in U.S. nuclear culture. And in fact, I would say a lot of the U.S. arsenal has historically and currently been postured for nuclear warfighting. The United States nuclear posture currently has a lot of weapons in it, which trend towards using early in a conflict and are designed specifically to be used before they are destroyed. And so now, as a result, we have this new weapon, the low-yield warhead for the nuclear submarines, that I would say probably creates more problems than it solves.
Paired with a posture that's organized around actually using these weapons, baby nukes are especially dangerous. Despite their smaller size, and in fact, because they're smaller, some analysts think they lower the threshold for entry into nuclear war enough that it starts to seem like not such a crazy idea. It's just 8 kilotons, after all. What's the harm?
I don't know. I worry sometimes about the idea of branding it as this low-yield thing. If we're talking about a 15-kiloton blast that destroyed Hiroshima, 8 kilotons is still, like, very significant. So in terms of making a more usable weapon, it constitutes a potentially somewhat tempting option for a president to reach toward in a crisis.
And then beyond that, there's an extra challenge that comes along with the W76 too, which is what happens once it's launched.
I guess I would suggest that, you know, once the first nuclear weapon goes flying, even if it is a low-yield nuclear weapon, all bets are off, right? Because how would Russia know that this isn't the precursor to some kind of massive attack?
Some experts have argued that early warning systems can't discriminate between a baby nuke and a regular-sized nuke on a submarine-launched missile. And that if Russia sees a missile, it's not going to wait to see which flavor of warhead is inside. If the U.S. were to actually use the W76-2, Russia would be forced to react as if it had just launched a full-scale nuclear attack. Meaning that these weapons are so risky, it's hard to imagine us choosing to use them at all.
That's Lacey Healy from the PRX National Security Podcast, Things That Go Boom. The story was produced by Emily Vaughn and Robin Wise. Tomorrow in our series, the long trail of U.S. military engagements that started after 9/11. Once again, in the north of Nigeria, there's been a mass kidnapping. Yesterday, according to Nigerian law enforcement, armed men raided the Bethel Baptist boarding school in Kaduna State, abducting 140 students. Today, we're learning that at least 26 students and a teacher have been rescued. The authorities are still pursuing the kidnappers. We're joined now by Confidence McHarry. He's a security analyst at SBM Intelligence in Lagos. What is the latest right now on this case, Confidence? Do we know who is behind this kidnapping?
Well, there are a couple of armed groups that are operating within Nigeria's northwest. Unlike in the past, where we had a couple of leaders came out to say that they are responsible, lately that has not been the case. So it speaks largely to the fact that a proliferation of armed groups within the North Central and the Northwest zone that even the Nigerian government is finding it hard to keep up with. We can only speculate as to previous intelligence reports from both the Nigerian Security Services and the U.S. Africa Command that 3 splinter groups of Boko Haram are all making a play for the Northwest and are in a recruitment overdrive. And so what they are trying to do right now is to absorb these established armed groups into their own network. And so either one of these people could be responsible.
Well, we don't want to speculate on who's responsible, but we know these kidnappings have been going on for years. And as you say, right now they're becoming more frequent. What's going on? Why is there this uptick?
The uptick is because of the ransom value.
The ransom money. So you're saying it's economic?
Yes, it is economic because every time a kidnap incident is reported, the next thing people do is to look for a ransom.
One thing we don't hear a lot about is how cases like this impact education, especially for girls. What have you been hearing, Confidence, from people who've been examining the impact?
The impact is massive in the sense that Nigeria already has, it feeds into Boko Haram's ideology against Western education in the sense that we already have reports that Boko Haram is trying to gain a foothold in the Northwest. And so the abductions that are leading state governments to actually close schools is actually a victory for Boko Haram. And if you close the school, you tend to have more children out of school, which, of course, forms the recruitment pool by which these various armed groups recruit from. And then if you choose to open the school, you subject the lives of the children and put them at stake. And so the government is in a tight fix right now. But generally, the impact on education is profound.
So what are some possible solutions to this? I mean, how can this economy of abductions be curbed and ultimately eliminated and give kids a chance to go to school?
In the first place, the government has to show that political will to go after the kidnappers. On the long term, it will need to invest heavily in its intelligence gathering capabilities and, more importantly, in its crisis response. So for the government to forestall this, it needs to show a lot of commitment and as well as tackle the economic challenges that brought the country into this position in the first place.
Confidence Makari is a security analyst at SBM Intelligence in Lagos, speaking with us about the most recent kidnapping of school students in northern Nigeria. Confidence, thank you very much. Good to speak with you again.
Thank you for having me.
Fashion magazines and street style blogs are great, but there's often something they overlook. Older people can have killer style too. That's something that photographer Andrea Lowe and writer Valerie Liu noticed when they were walking around Chinatown in San Francisco. It is the focus of their book, Chinatown Pretty, Fashion and Wisdom from Chinatown's Most Stylish Seniors. Andrea and Valerie, thanks for being here.
Thanks for having us.
So Chinatown Pretty, it's a term you've coined to describe the fashion of the older adults you profile. Valerie Liu, how would you define Chinatown Pretty style?
Chinatown Pretty style is a very eclectic mix of clothes that they've held over from Hong Kong 30 years ago, combined with things that they have made themselves or were gifted to them from their grandkids. So it's really a patchwork of eras, textures, colors, and lots of patterns, sometimes four patterns in one outfit.
And I think what drew us to the style to begin with was that their clothes did seem to tell a story. And we see that revealed in all of the handmade items. A lot of the women who migrated over worked as seamstresses in factories. So they're able to make their own clothes. And we see lots of gorgeous handmade pieces as well as lots of knitted sweaters and scarves and hats as well. The seniors really customize the clothes to make it work better for them. Mm. So we often see interior pockets that are hand sewn inside of the jackets or their shirts. Or we'll see them, you know, extend their hats or combine two hats to make one. And there's a lot of creativity and resourcefulness that comes about in these details.
Yeah, I mean, you say in the book, the secret to some of the style sense is all in the layers. Explain that.
So in San Francisco, we have a saying, which is never leave home without a jacket because the weather is so fickle and it can change in an instant. And in the case of Chinatown, it's like never leave the house with like four layers. Chinatown senior citizens are kind of the ultimate urban dwellers. They're out there every day shopping local, hanging out at the park. And so they need to be ready for all types of weather.
So it wasn't just San Francisco's Chinatown. You looked at several Chinatowns in North America, New York, Vancouver, Los Angeles, and Oakland. What drew you to older residents in particular?
Well, the project started with Valerie and I hanging out in Chinatown, getting dim sum and people watching. And we were really fascinated by the density of senior citizens we noticed in the neighborhood. They are very active and they're out and about buying groceries every day, using the parks and the plazas as their living room. So you'll see them playing games and socializing. You know, they're just out there. And we were really fascinated by that and wanted to learn more. So that curiosity and this fascination with this amazing style we were seeing really led us to start the project.
So let's talk about one example, a couple of examples maybe. Early in the book, you write about spotting a woman in San Francisco's Chinatown who was always wearing these fabulous jade green sneakers. Valerie, what is her story?
So Manning Tam is definitely a Cinderella story. I was really lucky to live in Chinatown for 6 months. And I would journal every day at this cafe. And I would see her get off the bus. And the first thing I noticed were these jade sneakers. They looked like Keds, something kind of straight out of Urban Outfitters. And then when I scanned up, I realized she had a silver bob. I was so shocked that she was like in her 70s. And I would always shake the person who was next to me like, did you see this person? And when we started the project a few months later, we actually met her one fateful day during the Lunar New Year and became fast, you know, friends. And eventually she became our cover model.
I mean, the profiles in Chinatown Pretty, they, of course, start with the clothes, but often take on bigger themes like history, but also the thoughts on life and just longevity from the elderly. What advice, what wisdom stuck with you?
We always end our interviews with, what's the secret to a happy life? Chinatown senior citizens are people that have experienced warfare, immigration, you know, a lot of work. They've often taken on second or third careers, even in their old age. And so there's a lot to learn from them about how to be resilient and how to, you know, find joy in everyday life. And there's one person that comes to mind, Ms. Yang, who we met in San Francisco Chinatown. She was a school teacher before she retired. And she said when she was younger, she was a perfectionist. But now she has Alzheimer's and she can't really remember, you know, even like when she immigrated over or how. But she said, listen, my kids are all good. I eat yum cha or dim sum with my friends. So life is good. If I can remember things, that's great. If I don't, that's all right, too. So learning how to accept the circumstances that you're in and finding peace in that.
Now, that's really poignant. Speaking of resilience, in the last few months, we've seen an awful uptick, as you know, in violence against Asian Americans and in particular older Asian Americans. I'm just wondering, what does it mean to you both to craft a portrait of these older adults in the midst of all of this?
This project has really been a celebration of our Asian elders. And we've heard from a lot of readers and people in the community that this has been a bright spot for them. And we're really thankful that we can share these photos and these stories with others.
Did this project kind of allow you to make intergenerational connections, even friendships that you otherwise would not have? I mean, have you stayed in touch with your subjects?
Lots of our experiences through Chinatown Pretty are ephemeral. We're catching people as they're about to board the bus with like 10 pounds of groceries.
Right.
So it's very temporary, and we're just lucky to have those interactions, and those stick with us. My takeaway from this project is just to weave senior citizens into your life. There was a gentleman in New York who was really frustrated that younger people, you know, don't interact with older people. And he's left us with a proverb. He said, listen, one day the sun will set on you as well. And our takeaway from that was treat senior citizens the way you'd want to be treated. I want to be complimented by a gaggle of women when I'm in my 80s. So we try to say, Dosan, good morning, and Popo Ho Lang, dang, grandma, you look good. So communicating with senior citizens, it's just a part of our daily life now.
Do unto others as you would have them do unto you when you are 70 years old. Has this project changed your own personal style or how you think about clothes? Are you layering more?
Yes, definitely layering more. And also just dressing more with abandon. I think that what we've learned is that seeing these seniors with the beautiful colors and, you know, it's this effortless style that really combines a lot of styles into one. So I've tried to incorporate that more into my outfits. It encourages me to try new things with my style too.
Photographer Andrea Lowe and writer Valerie Liu are the authors of Chinatown Pretty, Fashion and Wisdom from Chinatown's Most Stylish Seniors. It is great to meet you both. Thank you for being with us.
Thanks for having
us. Thank you.
Tensions are bubbling up between French champagne producers and Russia. A new law in Russia orders foreign champagne makers, including the French, to label their bottles as sparkling wine. The name champagne will be reserved only for Russian champagne or champonskoye. Just imagine the French reaction to that. Zut alors. You can read about it in our newsletter, Top of the World, emailed to your inbox every weekday. Sign up theworld.org/newsletters. The World comes to you from the Nana Bill Harris studio at GBH. I'm Marco Werman. We'll see you right back here tomorrow.
From PRX.